In June 1953, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, a couple with two young sons, were led separately from their prison cells in death row and electrocuted moments apart. Both had been convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage for the Soviet Union, despite the fact that the U.S. government was aware that the evidence against Ethel was shaky at best and based on the perjury of her own brother. Ethel Rosenberg in An American Tragedy is a new book by Ann Seba, which focuses on one half of that couple using new evidence, which has surfaced since then. 70 years after her trial, this is the first time Ethel's story has been told with the full use of the dramatic and tragic prison letters she exchanged with her husband, her lawyer, and her psychotherapist over a 3-year period, two of them in solitary confinement. Ann Seba is a prize-winning biographer, lecturer, and former Reuters foreign correspondent who has written several books, including That Woman and American Jenny. Ann is a senior research fellow at the Institute of Historical Research. We're also joined by Michael Mirapol, son of Ethel Rosenberg, who is a valuable source for Seba. And it is a great pleasure to welcome both Michael and Ann to the roundtable this morning. Thank you both for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Ann, let us begin with you as to how you came. I know it's probably difficult to pinpoint where and how you say, I'm going to write about a certain subject. But for this, do you know?
I was a young mother living in New York for a couple of years in the 1970s. And I came across the E.L. Doctorow book, the Book of Daniel. And I remember what a profound impression it made on me. Although, of course, it's a highly dramatic fictional account of a son and a daughter. And I was the mother of a son and a daughter. And of course, I didn't know that in reality, the Rosenberg story at that point, I wasn't aware that it was about two boys. But somehow the seed was planted and I needed to do a lot of growing up. I couldn't possibly have tackled that story then. But it came back to me 40 years later when I'd written a book about women in wartime France. And I was looking at a lot of spies in that book and SOE agents. And suddenly it dawned on me that we were approaching the 70th anniversary of the Rosenberg's death. And although there's no magic about a 70th anniversary, contrary to what publishers might think, it occurred to me that this was the right time to look again at the story, because I thought, wrongly, that perhaps tempers might have cooled, that this would be a fresh time to look at it, but also because I realized that people would still be alive, and principal among the people alive who I wanted to speak to were, of course, Ethel's two sons, Michael and Robbie. I didn't want to write an authorized book. I thought it was important to keep that independence and write it at arm's length. So I've really only got to know Michael and Robbie after the book was written. But that pretty much is how it happened.
Mike, give us a sense of what it has been like for you, in the sense of what you think this book accomplishes that adds to the many, many books that have been written about your parents.
Well, you just said the magic word, Joe, when you said parents. What Anne has done, and in my opinion, succeeded brilliantly, actually, is that she has recognized that, in fact, my parents are two people. They are not a pair of people fused into an unbreakable unit. They are actually two very separate people, even though they loved each other and supported each other. And Anne has been able to do that. And I think it's because, well, I don't want to sound sexist. I think it's in part because she's a woman. And she recognizes that women, especially women in the 1950s, were faced with rather dramatic challenges. And I don't even want to go into the various ways that my mother has been thought of by the media and by historians in the past. But Anne produced with a fresh set of eyes and perhaps a little British detachment from us Yanks. And she's a thorough researcher, as we knew from her earlier books. And Rob and I are very glad that we, A, cooperated with her, and B, were very careful not to try to impose our opinions on her.
And what was new out there that you felt had been missing from the story that you had access to? I know there were, we mentioned the letters in the introduction and other things that allowed you to get a fresh take on this.
Let me try and break that really important question down into two aspects. There are new facts, and principally, David Greenglass, who died in 2014, aged 92, Ethel's younger brother by 7 years, his grand jury testimony was finally revealed. And even though people had a fair idea that he had told a lie, it was his perjury about the typewriter that convicted Ethel. That was, in fact, the only quote-unquote evidence, the overt act that he had seen Ethel typing, and he denied when he came out of prison that he had actually seen Ethel typing. He admitted that probably nobody had, or possibly his wife, he really couldn't remember. But in the grand jury testimony, he says quite clearly nothing about Ethel. And when questioned, he said to the FBI agents, leave my sister out of it. My sister had nothing to do with it. So that was a story that he invented, and that was the story which sent Ethel to his death. So that's partly the new facts, but much more was a new interpretation. People have said this is a feminist biography. I don't recognize it as feminist. It's a book by a woman about a woman. So I hope I'm empathetic towards Ethel. But take, for example, the announcement after her death, because if people know anything about this story, it seems to me they say, the Rosenbergs, the spies. So as Michael said, my main idea was to try and extrapolate Ethel and see her as a mother struggling, as a woman in her own right, but not necessarily as a spy. But I really feel I kept an open mind. But the other thing that people know is about Ethel's gruesome and barbaric electrocution. Because if you listen to, for example, Bob Considine announcing, you know, the veteran Walter Cronkite of his day, the veteran journalist telling people what had happened, he could hardly get his words out. He stuttered over the word stethoscope. But then he explained how Ethel was given the normal three jolts that her husband had been given. And he commented, this would have been enough for any ordinary person. And I think you see in that remark the extraordinary misogyny that has enclosed this case ever since 1953, when Judge Irving Kaufman pronounced giving sentence that Ethel was a full-fledged partner in the crime because she was 2¾ years older than her husband, and all the misogyny down the line from establishment Jews like Morris Ernst, who insisted that Ethel was the master and Julius her slave. This attempt over the years to stick labels on Ethel is what I really found so extraordinary. And Ethel defies labeling. The Ethel I've discovered is of course complex, and I'm not pretending she's a saint, which of us is, but I think it really needed a new interpretation. And that's why, of course, all the great literature has been written in the 70 years since, from Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar to Angels in America. People cannot quite pin Ethel down. And I've tried not to pin her down and give her one label to stereotype her. So I think what's new is mostly that I've been prepared to settle for a complex figure who defies labeling.
I was surprised in reading the book about how strong even the president of the United States at the time, Dwight Eisenhower, was in that Ethel was the mastermind behind this and very much was in charge. So tell me how that perception came about because even in what was testified by Ethel and others in court did not really at all subscribe to that theory.
I hope this doesn't sound too immodest, but I like to think as a historian, I've really tried to place Ethel in context. So again, there are two important things to bear in mind here. First of all, and I don't deny there was a real existential threat, but it was whipped up by unscrupulous politicians into this fear and hysteria that Russia would drop an atomic bomb, having won the war. Perhaps America was in danger of losing the peace. So there was this terrific atmosphere of fear, and the American government had to find scapegoats in that atmosphere. But I think the other thing is the context of 1950s. Women were expected to stay in the home and be housewives. And Ethel was aware of that. And here is part of the complication. Part of her wanted to be that person. And I think when you understand this insistence that housewives in the late 1940s post-war were meant to stay in the home, somehow Ethel came to symbolize an attack on the American way of life. I mean, she was built into this sort of wicked witch idea that, you know, here was a woman who was selling the secrets and was guilty of a crime worse than murder, according to the judge, you know, almost guilty of causing the Korean War. It was hyperbole in the nth degree. And of course, you know, we realize now that it couldn't possibly be true. But I think, you know, if you look at the trial, for example, here are two practical examples of why Ethel came to symbolize this very wicked person who Eisenhower said had to be killed. The evidence that her younger brother David produced involved a typewriter. He'd seen Ethel typing. Now, so many men would identify with that, including the jury, which was mostly comprised of men, one woman. They would see a typist as perhaps their wife, perhaps their secretary, somebody they knew and recognized. And if you couldn't trust the woman who did the typing for you, who could you trust? So that was subliminally one of the things that was used to make Ethel seem such a wicked person. And the other piece of theatrical evidence that Roy Cohn, the 23-year-old prosecutor, brought in was this Jell-O box, the recognition symbol allegedly cut in an asymmetrical pattern. You know, Jell-O was something that every American housewife would understand and would use. And here is Ethel subverting a Jell-O box. So, you know, again, you can see how clever the prosecution is in this all too brief trial of the way Ethel was perceived.
Let me ask you the question before I ask Michael, but do you feel that she got a good defense? It is something that even she responds to in a letter toward the end of the book, where the defense, because there are so many protests to the execution, that the defense starts to get criticized quite heavily in the press. It is Ethel writing a letter saying, I'm very sorry that you are going through this.
Yes, well, of course, that's another question I had to grapple with. I sort of came to see Manny Block, her lawyer, as a bit of a hero in a way, because he was doing his best. And it's easy with hindsight to say that she was ill-advised to plead the Fifth Amendment. But at the time, that seemed the right sort of defense. And, you know, now, of course, if you reran the trial, you would advise her to admit straight up, look, I'm a communist, but it's not my communism that's on trial. I think, again, that goes back to this atmosphere of tremendous fear that communists were endangering the American way of life. And so she didn't feel she could admit to it. But the result was that the jury thought she was untrustworthy and shifty. The other thing I would say is that nobody else would take this on. So that's why, in a sense, Manny Block's a bit of a hero, simply for doing it and trying his best. But of course, he was out of his depth. I guess Michael will have a slightly different take on that answer.
Yeah, the decision to take the Fifth Amendment was actually my father's. He absolutely insisted that he would avail himself of all the protections of the American Constitution. He made a big deal in his trial testimony that he approved of the Anglo-Saxon system of justice. And even in the 2 years that they waited to see if they would be reprieved or get a new trial, he was constantly in the belief that the American system of justice would save them, because yes, he was technically guilty of conspiracy to commit espionage, but half the things said about him at the trial, maybe three quarters of the things, were outright lies, and he knew it. So if he could only expose some of the perjuries of the prosecution, he could win a new trial. He could certainly get clemency. And, you know, as somebody who, you know, made his decision to try and help an ally during World War II, he was willing to suffer the consequences. What he was hoping, of course, was that a new trial would exonerate at least my mom.
I was struck, and this is for both of you, but I was struck very much by the letters written by your mother, Michael. They are beautiful. I mean, they are really beautifully written, thoughtful letters in what is an unimaginable state of mind, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I know the letters probably as well as anybody, because in 1993 and 1994, I sat with all 500 plus of them and meticulously typed them, spelling errors and cross outs and inserts and all, over two full summers before finding a publisher who was willing to publish them. And that's not all of them. There are a handful that are sitting at BU that Anne found that never made it into our book.
And for you, as a historian of what they meant, and also just commenting on the depth of them.
Well, I agree. And I know some of them were written for public consumption. So, I was always aware that some of the letters between Ethel and Julius were written for a wider public. They needed to try and raise money. But I think the letters to Michael and Robbie are extraordinary. And I can read those two letters at the end, and I find my eyes welling up every time I read them. It's so unimaginable to have to say goodbye. I think it's not only the letters, actually. One of the moments in her prison sentence that I found particularly insightful was when she was preparing for the first visit of Michael and Robbie, having not seen them for several months because she hoped that she could avoid seeing them in prison and that the first meeting would be after they were released. So, you know, what is at her disposal to play with these two kids? And I've grown up in a materialistic era where we'd go to the local toy shop before a plane ride, you know, and you'd stock up on toys to keep the kids happy. And that was hardly an option. So Ethel collects dead insects and puts them into envelopes to entertain the children. And I've puzzled and puzzled over that. And eventually I had a discussion with an analyst friend of mine who said to me, "This is extraordinary, Anne, because the insight that Ethel is showing into the situation is that she's prepared to tackle the elephant in the room, which is death. And so she's collecting dead insects, and she's showing the children, without being too heavy-handed, that death can be beautiful and death isn't necessarily the end. You know, an ordinary mother would be able to go to the park with her children and tear off a piece of bark from a tree and a whole lot of live creepy crawlies would come out. Well, that wasn't an option for Ethel, so she did the best thing in the circumstances." And having enjoyed that interpretation, I just felt it gave me great insight into the fact that Ethel was really thinking about, you know, what is the best I can do? And that helped me understand how she ultimately came to the decision she did. I mean, I don't believe she had a real decision at the end. I think she was trapped. But ultimately, I think she decided that the only legacy she could leave was one of loyalty and not betrayal. If her green glass birth family stood for betrayal, she was going to distance herself as much as possible from them and offer loyalty as a legacy. And I mean, it's an interpretation, but it's the only way I was able to make sense of Ethel thinking about her children in prison.
In reading about the case previously, I don't remember Ethel's mother, Michael, your grandmother, coming off so badly. A tragedy and not supporting her daughter, not supporting and not going to her funeral, and also believing that she was that ultimately Ethel should have taken the responsibility away from her brother. It's really quite remarkable.
Well, I absolutely do describe my book sometimes as a family story. I mean, I see this very dysfunctional family on the one side, where Ethel's mother, for whatever reason, was bitter or corrosive and did not value Ethel's talents. I mean, Ethel was clever. Ethel was bright. And for all I know, Tessie was bright, but had no education and felt, well, I haven't been able to progress. So felt this bitterness towards her daughter. And also it was partly of its time. You know, if you have sons, they're the ones who need to be educated. And after several miscarriages, finally this chubby cheek, curly hair, gorgeous David comes along, who everyone in the family loves. And all Tess's love goes into David. And she never valued Ethel's clever talents. She thought she was a snob because she sang Italian arias and cared about Russian peasants when there were other concerns at home. But I mean, I've bookended this dysfunctional family with what I call the redemptive family, the other side, and the awful trial in between. I wonder if actually Tessie was that unusual of immigrant Jewish mothers at the time who believed that education for girls didn't matter. I realize not all mothers felt that, but probably she was not alone.
And let's remember, I mean, when David was arrested, he was her son. I mean, sons are very important. And not only she, but her, you know, her other sons believed David. They believed that David was honestly telling the truth about his spying and that Julius and Ethel had gotten David involved in this, and that Ethel should immediately do what David and Ruth did. And when Ethel refused to do it, then she, I mean, if you're looking at it from Tessie's point of view, it's Ethel's fault for standing with her husband in communism rather than David and the family and America. So Tessie very, you know, memorably, after my mother was killed, told a reporter that she died a soldier of Stalin. You know, and of course, what could she do? She was the mother of a daughter and a son, and she chose her son. End of story.
Well, she also chose not to have a relationship with you or your brother.
Well, she had the relationship until we started to live with Sophie Rosenberg in 1952. And then after that, I mean, she called me once and I remember saying, I hear you're not on our side. And she said, your mama and daddy should come home. And I said, oh, but I never saw her again. And I never thought positively of her again. And I remember a quote from my mother when she talked about Sophie Rosenberg, her mother-in-law, who supported Ethel and Julius tremendously, was very, very strong. I only have one mother now. That was my mother's line. Mm. And very sad, horribly sad. But as I said, I think on some level, you can recognize Tessie Greenglass as somebody who chose her son. And there are an awful lot of mothers who would have chose their sons if they had a choice.
You were 10 years old when your parents were killed, your brother was six. And yet that doesn't tell really the true story, because for 3 years of that, they were in prison. So I just wonder how much do you remember, and how much is it paramount in your mind of their time with you, given the tumultuous nature of it?
Well, I guess I remember a lot. And, you know, I believe I shared a lot of my memories with Anne. And of course, Rob and I wrote We Are Your Sons when we were a lot younger and therefore closer to the memories back in 1974. It had a very strong impact. And I cling to a couple of sentences in Anne's book. Anne, I'm so grateful that you got to talk to Betty Phillips. Betty Phillips said to Anne that Robbie and my health is based on three things. The foundation we got from mom and dad. She also is very nice. She says our natural characters or natural intelligence. And of course, the saviors, Abel and Anne Mirapol, who, in my opinion, saved our lives.
Yes. Anne?
Well, this is very embarrassing for me to say in front of Michael, but I have written it, so I'll repeat it. What Betty Phillips actually said were three things turned Michael and Robbie into such good citizens and not bitter about their parents' death. And one of them was the fact that they were both super bright. And the second one was the redemptive power of the Mirapols. And the third one was that, as we now know, those early years of mothering are key. And Ethel must have been an extraordinarily good mother in those early years. So I do think those three things are an interesting take, because it's one of the questions I'm asked in most interviews, even when Michael isn't here. What happened to the sons? How on earth did they survive seeing their parents so publicly vilified? You know, why didn't they become martyrs to their parents' memories? And so, you know, I have at least Betty Phillips, who I believe is now 100, but who has a very sharp memory of helping Ethel with Michael in those pre-arrest days. And I'm able to quote her rather than my interpretation.
Early in the book, and you make it very clear that Michael especially was a difficult child to raise. He was, there was a lot going on there.
Well, you know, he was a first son, and he was challenging. He was challenging all the boundaries. And Ethel wasn't well. She had scoliosis, and the scoliosis often resulted in migraines. And listen, any mother who has had a child who doesn't sleep and who's demanding, it's really not an unusual story. But Ethel didn't have any help. And not only did she not have any help because her mother wasn't helping her, but she so wanted to be a better mother than her mother had been to her. So I think she set herself impossibly high standards. It was the era of the perfect mother. I mean, let's remember, what year was Dr. Spock published? 1946. So suddenly mothering became a perfectible science. And perhaps it's not surprising that Ethel thought, being a clever bookish child, well, I can learn how to be a good mother. So she read, she had a subscription to Parents magazine, which she kept up in prison. She went to mothering classes, and, you know, typically not just any old mothering classes, but those run by a Viennese emigre called Edith Buxbaum. You know, she set herself these very high standards. And I think if I've tried to do anything in this book, it's, as I said at the beginning, partly to separate Ethel, but really to give her back her humanity. I think what's been taken away because of the insistence on turning her into a stereotype is that she lacks humanity. And I wanted to see her in as many dimensions as I could, and to see her as a fully rounded human being, mother, wife, daughter, sister, all of those things.
Michael, is it weird to read about yourself in the early years of your life and the stress that you put on your parents?
It was actually weirder to hear it when I interviewed family members in my 30s. You know, obviously I had repressed it. As far as I was concerned, I was the perfect child. And to find out that I wasn't, well, I learned it in my 30s, and I sort of forgave that kid. Although, you know, when I had my own children, I was very happy that they weren't anywhere near as challenging as I had been.
And I was struck by something you said before we went on the air, actually, about keeping up with the mail. I assume this is still a controversial story, right? I mean, this is still something that is polarizing in many ways. So what do you hope with this book and telling the story of Ethel Rosenberg that the legacy becomes, that your wish for the legacy to be?
Thank you for that. You're right. It is provocative, and I understand that. I would argue always that extremism doesn't win arguments, that it's possible to hold more than one idea in your head. Ethel could be a communist and, still innocent of the charges. And I guess it's the miscarriage of justice that most affects me. The fact that so much inadmissible evidence, which would make it a mistrial today. So in answer to your question, is there any legacy I hope for? That people understand the importance of the rule of law. That's really what it boils down to for me.
And Michael, when it comes to your mother specifically, but your parents overall, you have worked obviously very hard in telling the story over the years and trying to get facts out of your thoughts on if it, with the story written of what we that most people should think.
Well, the short version of that is from the basis of the research we've done, some of it supplemented by Anne's work as well, the government wanted to convict my father and get him to name names. When he wouldn't do it, they said, well, we'll arrest his wife and give her a stiff sentence. And that would get him to name names. And basically what they did is they took a hostage. They took an innocent hostage. And when my father and she would not come across, they murdered the hostage. I hope people will learn that, because that is actually the truth of the history.
As far as guilt or innocence, how do you look? Is it different from your mother to your father?
Yes, I would say my father was technically guilty of conspiracy to commit espionage. I would remind people that that was in favor of an ally. He's sort of like Jonathan Pollard, who did the same thing for Israel. He did it during World War II for an ally. And my mother was his wife. And we speculate, my brother and I, that she didn't get involved so that if he were arrested, she could stay home and take care of us. Well, guess what? The government ruined that plan by arresting her, framing her, and ultimately killing her. As I said, they killed the hostage. I can't make it any plainer than that.
The name of Anne's new book, which is just remarkable, is Ethel Rosenberg, An American Tragedy. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Anne, I thank you so much for being with us. And Michael, I so appreciate your guidance and input as well. Thank you.
I thank you. It's lovely to be able to talk about it. Thank you.
And it's always a pleasure to be on WAMC, Joe. Give my regards to the whole staff.
I will indeed. Michael Mirapol and Seba, thank you very much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.